Welcome to ContraPulse. This is Julie Valamont. Today we talk with pianist, accordionist, and singer Mary Kay Brass. She has played in bands that were mainstays of the New England contra scene in the last decades, such bands as the Greenfield Dance Band and Air Dance, as well as many other projects. Mary Kay began her involvement with traditional music at the age of 9 when her Croatian neighbors invited her to join a children's folk dance troupe. In the 1970s, she spent 2.5 years in the former Yugoslavia studying traditional song and dance on a Fulbright scholarship. After that, she moved to New York City, where she picked up an old accordion from a Swedish accordion collector in Minneapolis and began a lifelong love of that instrument as an accompaniment to the songs of Eastern Europe. At the same time, she was introduced to the contra dance musical traditions of New England and began passionately learning everything she could about the piano backup traditions to fiddle tunes, as well as learning the tunes on accordion. This led to a move to southern Vermont in 1984, where she became part of a thriving traditional music scene. Forming the Greenfield Dance Band with fiddler David Kaner and bassist Stuart Kenny, and later guitar and mandolin player Peter Siegel, Mary Kay began playing regularly in Greenfield and throughout the country at dances, festivals, and camps. She has numerous recordings with fiddlers Rodney Miller, Sarah Blair, Becky Tracy, David Kaner, and others. On both piano and accordion, she has the rhythmic drive and energy that make her a much sought-after musician. Mary Kay worked for more than 8 years as a classroom music teacher in public and private schools in southern Vermont. And she worked with the New England Dancing Masters as an artist in residence in New England schools, working thematically with teachers to create programs of songs and folk dances. Mary Kay has also led village harmony camps for teens and adults for 30 years, a singing camp that focuses on traditional singing from many cultures, and she leads 2 highly successful community choirs. It was truly a pleasure to speak with her on ContraPulse. In our interview, we talk about her early days getting started playing for contras, her experiences as a contra musician over several decades, her piano style and influences, and her passion for the music of Quebec and New England, in addition to numerous other styles. The opening track you're hearing is from the Greenfield Dance Band's album High Clouds. Later in the episode, we'll hear music from Air Dance and from her solo album, Green Mountain. Hello, Mary Kay Brass. Welcome to ContraPulse.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a beautiful September day. Kind of warm. We had that little cold snap, and now it's back in the 70s again.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Yeah,
very
great.
The colors were amazing driving down here.
Are you coming from a little bit north of here?
Yeah, Athens.
Athens. Have your fall colors started already?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, we're just getting the little hints of it here. I think that last weekend really started it off.
Yep.
And it is trucks that go by because it's a Friday and people are working, yeah. So we'll just ignore them. People are getting used to the weird sounds on my porch in these interviews.
Yeah, that's fine.
And I'm so grateful to have you here. I haven't seen you for quite some time, but you were really the person that I learned contrapiano from the most when I was first starting out.
I didn't even know that.
I was kind of stealthy about it. But in 2008, you did a piano class at Pinewoods at American Week. And I went to that. And that was like a couple of years before that I had started kind of playing contrapiano. Like a couple of my friends kind of gently pushed me into it. And but I didn't know what I was doing and I really wanted to learn. And then I saw this opportunity. And that was the first time I ever went to Pinewoods and you were there. And I just, I soaked up every single thing you said that week. I recorded the whole thing. I took it home and I transcribed it. So if you ever want an extremely detailed transcription of your week-long workshop, I can totally give you all my notes.
Wow. No, I have no idea. But I do remember that. I remember you being there, but I don't. I didn't realize you transcribed every word.
You never know, do you?
Nope. Nope.
Well, do you want to tell us a little bit about how you got started playing for contras and your musical background?
Yeah. Well, I was originally really, really involved in a lot of Eastern European music and folk dance. And I first actually heard about contra dance music, and I didn't actually even realize that there was a dance idiom that went with the music, but I was in North Carolina riding in a friend's car in the back seat in the days when people had cassettes, and somebody put on a cassette of the Canterbury Country Orchestra, and I'd never heard of them. I didn't know what this music was, but I was really taken with the piano playing, which was, of course, Bob McQuillan. And I just said to my friends right at that moment, it was like one of those prophetic things. I just said, I'm going to learn to do this. And I'm going to get good at it. I was just like, I was just inspired, I guess. And I asked my friends to make me a copy of that tape. So they did. Reel to reel, a tape. And I brought it home to New York City where I was living. And I had a friend who was, we were also both learning accordion at that time. And I gave her the cassette and I said, here, learn this one tune. And I'm going to try to figure out the piano part to this one tune. And I remember the tune. It was Coleraine, the jig. And I went measure by measure. I didn't play by ear at this point. I only read music. And I kind of believe there were two kinds of people, people who read music and people who just naturally somehow know how to play by ear. And I was not that. So, but I really wanted to learn this style, and there was no way to learn it except by ear. So I just went measure by measure, and I started with the left hand. I mean, I can remember to this day exactly what Mac was doing on that tune. Wow. And because I just absorbed that tune, and then I went on to another tune on that tape, and my friend Vicky, I would learn another accordion tune, and then I would learn to back that up and sort of really slowly. And I really didn't even know what the dance tradition was that went with this, because I was really involved in folk dancing in New York City and the folk arts organization that I was involved with put on live music once a month, I think. And it would be from different traditions. It would be Greek one month and Macedonian and Albanian. And one month it was contra dancing. And it was Todd Whittemore and Andy Davis and Rodney Miller. And I didn't know any of these people. It was just, and I stood the whole time behind Andy, like glued to his hands, like watching what they did. And he noticed me finally and said something like, are you a piano player? And I said, yeah, I'm just trying to learn this style of piano. And So it turned out that we ended up making a date for him to come to my apartment and give me a lesson. And that was kind of my first lesson. And I recorded everything and learned, you know, everything that he taught me in that lesson. And yeah, so that was the beginning.
Wow. Isn't that funny that you just hear something and you just know in that moment that you want to do it? And then you do it.
Yeah, there haven't been too many things in my life where it's been that clear that it was not even like something to think about. You know, it was just like, I am going to do this.
Mm-hmm. Were you a contra dancer before that?
No. I that was my first contra dance that I ever saw was at this Ethnic Folk Arts Center in New York City.
Wow. And but somehow you heard this music and you just were compelled to it, drawn to it.
Well, I had been a music major in college, and piano was my major, mm-hmm. and, you know, I played classical music, but I never played anything like this, and I had never played by ear, and I don't know, I was just driven to want to learn it bad enough that I taught myself to play by ear.
Amazing. Yeah, I made that transition. I was also a classical player. It's a very common one. So what were the things you did in learning piano? Like, who did you study from and what did you listen to? And how did you make that switch in your brain of learning to play by ear?
I went to the very first year of Ashokan. And many of those early years of Ashokan, and as first a camper and then a staff person. So there were a lot of different musicians there that I learned from. Various, especially Quebecois musicians, I was always really attracted to that style. Mm-hmm. And particularly Mario Loisel was a favorite of mine. And I was at many camps with him at both Ashokan and Pinewoods. And I feel like I learned a lot from him. And I wish he were here today that I could tell him, you know, the things you don't tell people, you know, that you just take for granted or something. But he was a lovely man, and I'm starting to play some of his tunes that I really love. He was a wonderful tunesmith, too.
Just for context, and correct me if I'm wrong, but he was a well-known piano player from Quebec.
Yes, and there were other Quebecois piano players that I really liked, and I can't remember their names right now. It's just like, it was way back there, you know, in the 80s, and I just am not remembering names. I remember that I was really taken by the group Héritage, and I can't remember who their piano player was, and I tried to Google it and couldn't find it, but whoever it was, I know I learned a lot from that piano player, too, And really, I used to do probably what you were talking about having done after that week at Pinewoods is just laboriously go through recordings and imitate other people until it becomes your own and evolves into something that's yours. You know, I think that's what I did. Yeah. And definitely McQuillan was a big early influence, and I feel like you know, McQuillan's left hand and his just real, he just really sticks to the boom chuck, you know, and I feel like I'm never far away from that boom chuck, you know, it's really close by.
Yeah.
For me. And
I think that's what drew me into your playing. Like, when I was learning, I just started to pay attention to different piano players, and out of just about everybody, I gravitated towards your playing, and I think it's very grounded in rhythm, and yet it has all these, like, subtleties of texture and tone, and, you know, like you mentioned, also being inspired by dadgad guitarists and that kind of thing. And so I think that combination of this, like, fantastic rhythm, also a lot of drama, which we can talk about. And then all these little, like, harmonic sonorities that you would do, a lot of which I incorporated into my own playing. Hope that's cool.
You know, that's what we all do.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Like, either subconsciously or consciously,
Yeah. Sometimes we intentionally take elements of other people's styles and bring them in our own. I mean, that's kind of how traditions should work, really.
Yeah.
And then also sometimes we're drawn to someone because they have a similar aesthetic that we do, or our styles are already similar in a way. So.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
So when did you start like really playing for contra dances, like having gigs? Because it can be a little hard as a piano player to get a start on stage when there's no, it's very exposed. There's nowhere to kind of quietly learn.
Well, I was living in New York City at that time, and I started going to sessions with various friends. Some friends in my neighborhood where I was living had a session on, and I started going to it and playing, you know, accordion, or if someone else wasn't playing piano, I would sit down at the piano. And I think eventually some of us formed a band and started playing for some of the CDS New York dances. But really, actually, not too long after, I started coming to New England to like weekends. Like I'd come up for a Dawn Dance weekend, and I started connecting and getting to know people up here. Like I had met Andy, and you know, we'd come up and visit him. He was living in New Hampshire at the time, in Acworth, and then I met David Kaner, and he was, as he always is with new musicians, welcoming. And so as I met more people up here, I was really drawn to moving up here, and I never meant to stay in New York even as long as I did, but I ended up going to grad school and then getting a really good job that I loved. And so it became harder to leave, but I eventually did it. It was the right time. And so it was about 84 that I moved here. It wasn't very long after I moved here that David started asking me to do gigs, and just things started to open up. There was a fiddler from the South that moved to the area, Bo Bradham, mm-hmm. who I started playing with. And actually that was my first recording, was a recording that we made that you might not even know about.
Yeah, I don't. What was it called?
It was called The Belle of Brattleboro. Hmm. It was named after a boat that was called The Belle of Brattleboro, and we got hired to play on that boat. It was like a tour boat on the West River.
Hmm.
And people could just buy a ticket and go for a ride at night, you know, and it was very sweet. So we did this tape in the mid-80s, and that was my first recording.
Mm-hmm.
People have since digitized that tape, but it's not very well digitized.
Yeah.
It's kind of hissy.
Yeah.
There's a lot of extraneous sound. But yeah, and that's when we started the Greenfield Band.
Mm-hmm. The Greenfield Dance Band.
Yeah.
Classic.
Yeah. It was a great time. I mean, I think it was about this time where Cammie Kaner, who had run the Northfield Dance, that hall was lost. The town of Northfield took it over, and I think Cammie moved to Boston at that time, started a family. And so David took over, and we started playing dances at the Guiding Star Grange. And I think, you know, Stuart was there, and David and me and various other people. There were always guests, and that was such a fun thing about it. There were always different people playing with us. And eventually Peter Siegel came along and became a permanent fixture as well for that dance. And those were wonderful days of that dance, yeah.
Who were some of the people who played with you?
Lissa Schneckenberger,
mm-hmm.
when she was like 14 years old. George Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Tracy Scott, old friend of David's, lives in Eastern Mass. Just some people whose names I cannot even think of, people who would be visiting from the West Coast we would have as guests. There were just so many people over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't even really remember all of them. But Lissa was quite often, I think David was a real mentor for her. And so she would come down quite often and play with us as she was, when she was a teenager. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was a new dancer and a new piano player, I remember starting to come out to Greenfield from Boston. And the Greenfield Dance Band dances were often the ones I ended up at. And I just loved that culture where people could sit on the stage and it just felt like a big community party up on the stage.
Yeah.
You know, and David had sit-ins welcome. So yep. I just remember sitting up there watching you all play and just observing how everything worked and kind of soaking it in and enjoying the view from the stage.
Yeah.
And it was a real feeling of camaraderie that then I didn't feel the same way about in most of the dances in Boston. Either they were too big and so sit-ins just weren't practical, or they had a lot of kind of name bands with repertoire where sitting in is hard, or there were some sit-in friendly dances. But that was when I have so many good memories of that dance and that sound and
yeah.
You guys just playing tunes and the groove and rhythm section and David's fiddle harmonies.
Yeah, really. There are so many good things. Yeah, no. It was a great rhythm section. Peter and Stuart and I was a blast always playing together. And David always made every fiddler sound twice, like twice the fiddler they were with his beautiful harmonies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a gift that he has.
Yeah.
It's like rhythmic harmonization, the way he plays.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just really, really a gift. And that's kind of how I found my way into it is through the Greenfield Dance and then going to camps and meeting other musicians and making connections and
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Eventually, air dance started. How did all that come about?
I had played a lot of duo gigs with Rodney over the years. Just various things. And also, we did a trip to England and Scotland. Mm-hmm. And that was a tour that was organized by maybe Folkworks in England. And David Oliver on Folkworks, I think. And we did a couple weeks of touring and playing with other bands in Scotland and England. That was, the way back in the 90s. And I'm not exactly sure how air dance evolved out of that. I really don't remember.
I mean, sometimes these things just happen so organically that yeah. you kind of don't know.
I know. I think it was probably one of those things. And, oh, you know what? I think it had to do with Great Meadow Music. I think that they approached maybe Rodney and said, we'll fund a recording if you create a band to, or something like that. Yeah. It's getting clearer right now.
It's all and, coming back.
And so that's, and then we did this recording with David Surratt, Stuart, me, Rodney, and Sam Zucchini. And then we had to come up with a name. And I do remember sitting there with long sheets of paper, brainstorming names for that band. And eventually we came up with Air Dance. And then it became its own thing for a bunch of years, maybe like 8 years.
Yeah.
Had a good run.
Yeah, another iconic band. Yeah. And I just remember hearing that rhythm section too and be like, what a rhythm section. Of course, it has a lot in common with, you know, a lot of overlap in personnel.
Yes, well, Stuart and I.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
But, like, that's when I really fell in love with the sound with, like, guitar plus piano plus bass together, or piano plus mandolin plus bass, or just, it's just a really great sound.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that was a great sound and a lot of creativity and, yeah, lots of great gigs in that period.
It's not a sound we hear a lot of anymore in contrabands, like piano as a part of a bigger rhythm section. Like I'm trying to think. Great Bear had piano, but with electric guitar often and, you know, foot percussion or drums, like different kind of setting. And there are a lot of bands that have a piano. And there are a lot of bands that have a guitar. I remember Celticlada, one of Randy Miller's band, had piano and guitar. Eric Anderson and Tom Hodgson, and then a few other folks. And Eric was another person who I learned to play contra piano from. And like you, he used to let me sit on stage during his gigs with Randy, and I would just watch his hands.
Yeah.
I couldn't get enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did it change your playing being in a rhythm section like that? Oh, I forgot to mention Tidal Wave. That's another band I was thinking of. Of course, it has Stuart in it, but another band with like a really close piano, bass, rhythm section.
Yep.
Groove.
Yep. Yeah.
And there are, of course, others. I'm sorry that I forgot you. It doesn't mean I don't appreciate you. Dear other bands.
Yeah. So did you just ask me another question?
Yeah, I did, and then I cut myself off. I just asked you what it's like playing in a rhythm section like that versus playing as the only rhythm instrument.
It's very freeing, actually. And it's very, there's so much support and a lot of listening to each other. And, you know, there's a real force in a rhythm system section like that that I really love, because you can create the drama as a force and you're not just one instrument trying to create some drama within the course of a whole dance, you know, but you've got this team working with you that are kind of on the same wavelength and really listening to each other and going with that drama. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And then you made Green Mountain at some point.
Yeah, that was another Great Meadow suggestion. They said, gee, there's so many great musicians, women musicians, and in New England. And they really liked my playing, and they just said, would you put together something? And they kind of gave me free range to do whatever I wanted. And so I asked various people, Becky Tracy and Sarah Blair and Mary Lee, And Susan Conger was on a couple of cuts, especially the Scandinavian. And yeah, it was that was a fun album to make, and it became kind of a popular album.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's out of print now.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
I'm glad I have a copy. And Susan Kevra is on that Calling
as well? That was on a different
one. That's a different one. Okay.
That was called Full Swing.
Full Swing.
Yes. And Susan did Calling on it, and the cuts were long enough to be used for dancing. You know, they weren't just three times through. So each one was more like dance length, so that people, if they were like teaching a beginner crowd or something, could use those if they didn't have a band handy. I guess that was some of the idea behind making that CD. Anyway, yeah, that was some of the same musicians are on it too. Sarah and Becky and Mary, I think, are on both those mm-hmm. albums. Yeah.
You know, we don't have a lot of like record labels in the Contra world or trad world anymore, and it was a really like Great Meadow Music has had a really important role.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of great albums in their catalog.
Right, and they kind of they had their finger on the pulse of an era mm-hmm. with their recordings. You know, that I think because they were funding all these recordings, I mean, most musicians didn't have a lot of money to put into, you know, $10,000 recordings. And so they really, I feel like what they gave us was a gift of all these recordings that they funded. And I know I would never have had the money to make, you know, I think I made 6 different recordings with them.
Wow.
Yeah. The 3 Air Dance and Greenfield Dance Band did one, and then the Green Mountain and Full Swing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like now how do bands make recordings? A lot of them now use Kickstarter.
Right.
But there was a time in between when there wasn't really Kickstarter and there weren't necessarily record labels. But I think it's an interesting creative process to approach musicians with the project and invite them to make it. You might get different things than if they're all making their individual albums with their bands or solo albums or something. You get a different kind of sound.
Yeah.
Different kind of project. And so
right.
If anyone's listening and you want to start a record label, I'm sure Contra bands would be very happy to make music for you.
I know. It's a really different era now. And I'm just grateful that they really recorded an era.
Yeah.
That era. I guess the 90s and early 2000s. I'm not sure when they did their last CD. I'm not quite sure what the spectrum was with them, but anyway, I'm glad that they did what they did.
Yeah. It's funny because to me that sound is like one of the classic sounds, like quintessentially New England Contra dance music. But then, of course, that's the era that I kind of came up in and learned from. And so, you know, we've talked a lot on this podcast about, like, what is traditional, and it depends on who's defining it and, you know, traditional for a certain period of time. But, man, that was a good era. Really,
yeah, really good it's era. Always – I mean, I think as recordings became more available and people could – at first buy cassettes, and you can copy cassettes, and you can record other people, as recording became easier, you know, the learning and the cross-fertilization, I think, started to really exponentially grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of synergy there. So would you be interested in telling us a little bit about your piano style and like what your approach is or what kind of styles you play or anything you'd want to say about it? Or I can regurgitate your entire 2008 piano class for you if you want.
Wow. Well, I think, you know, I feel like I really back up different styles of, like the different kinds of tunes that feed into the New England contradance world seemed to come from Quebec, and then Irish, Scottish traditions, old time traditions, and then old New England traditions. And I feel like I do something a little bit different for all of those. And I try to use what I know of Quebecois backup style with those, with that genre of tunes. I feel like with Irish tunes, you know, I really tried to absorb a lot, as you said, from dadgad guitar players. I love what they do for Irish tunes, and I think I tried to imitate that sound on the, as best I could on the piano, and then for old time tunes, I feel like it's just really bare bones rhythm, not a lot of maybe some walking bass things happening, but not too much. Really, it's just about kind of staying ahead of the beat and just playing really choppy, driving chords, but not very many chords. It's easy to play too many chords in an old time tune. And I'll never forget, I was at Fiddle Tunes and giving a piano workshop, and a guitar player was there who was there accompanying kind of a famous old-time fiddler, an older gentleman who I didn't really know. But he came to my piano class to get ideas. And then, you know, we were doing a tune like Sandy River Bell or something, and I played what chords I played for him, and he looked at me and he shook his head and he said, "I'd get fired if I played all those chords." So that made me really simplify more when I played old-time tunes, you know, that mm-hmm. I really thought about that. And I thought, yeah, it's not about the fancy chords. It's really just about the support of the rhythm. So, yeah, I think that's kind of a summary.
And you use a lot of, like, kind of harmonic lines in your playing. Like, I remember you teaching something you called harmonizing the scale. Or I remember it's, maybe I call it that, but I thought you called it that, where you'll walk down the whole scale in thirds, like block chords as you go down scale.
Uh-huh. I remember. Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember exactly what that means, but I probably do it, and I probably gave it that name, but I don't exactly remember.
Like if you're going from a one chord to a four chord, like yeah. from D to G, you might walk up like D, E, F sharp, G in the bass.
Yeah.
And then you would harmonize that with like a D chord and then a G chord and then a D chord over F sharp and then a G chord, like in your right hand.
Yeah. Yep, definitely.
And so a lot of these like moving chords, which is a very rich style, which is a little bit more than a bare bones boom check where the right hand is more than just an offbeat, you know, the left hand being the bass. Like Bob McQuillan might have played that as a bass run, where you would play it as a two-handed bass run on the left, but with a harmonic complement on the right side.
Yeah, and I feel like I got a lot of those ideas from dadgad guitar players, too, because mm-hmm. they do a lot of that.
Like the way they just move around on the fretboard.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I really like that sound and the movement it gives, the melody, and yeah, and the kind of airiness, spaciousness of it,
mm-hmm.
that sound, too. And, yeah, like using a lot of sus chords. And, yeah, I think I'm not real good at articulating, you know, what it's easier for me to hear someone else articulate and go, yeah, that's probably right.
That thing. Well, also, you know, it's hard without a piano in front of you. So much of it is just like in your hands and your body. And
it's kind of intuitive at this point. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But I also remember watching you play, and you would do this thing that I just thought of as like, this is a very Mary Kay thing to do, where it would be like a couple from the end and you'd build up to this five chord for like the whole B part. You'd be building. And then you just do this crash, like octaves down the piano, crash, 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 crash.
Yeah.
And then back to the A1.
Yeah, definitely. I recognize that. Drama.
Yeah,
definitely drama. It's very fun.
Yeah. And so instead of a glissando, which some people might do, you're doing these like block chords down an octave each time on each beat. Yeah.
And they were kind of sus chords too. They weren't just the chord. It would like I added extra notes for kind of adds a little more oomph to the chord to add these little, you know, major seconds within a chord. You know, it wasn't just 1-3-5, mm-hmm. but there'll be maybe 1-2-3-5 or 1-3-5-6.
It makes it a little crunchier sound.
Crunchier sounding, yep.
A little more bite to it.
Mm-hmm. Bite, that's a really good word. Yeah, definitely.
Did you ever play keyboards, or were you one of the people who really prefers an acoustic piano?
Oh, no, I almost always play keyboards. Yeah. In the olden days, every hall had old uprights, but they eventually became untunable, mm-hmm. at least not at 440. Mm-hmm. Right. And so if you were playing with any fixed pitch instruments, you know, it got impossible. And those old uprights kind of just bit the dust, and everyone started to move towards keyboards because they were always in tune and they were portable. And so, yeah, for a long, long, long time, I've played keyboards. And also the really nice thing about having a keyboard is that you can have eye contact with your band. And that goes a long way for communication. And having my back to the musicians was, you know, not good for my neck. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd get lots of aches and pains from, you know, twisting around trying to make eye contact with the band. So, yeah, I love my keyboard.
Yeah, and then when you travel with it, you always have the same predictable thing everywhere you go.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I didn't travel with it on airplanes, but
right.
I just trusted events to provide, you know, good keyboards. But yeah, around New England, definitely, I would just bring it to every gig.
Yeah, it's just nice.
It would just basically live in my car.
Yeah, why even take it out? For years, my car was just a rolling keyboard garage. That's what I called it.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of like that. It still is, actually, because of my choirs, except not now, of course, but during COVID. But yeah, I just leave it in there during my choir seasons too. So. Thank you.
So you've also, you know, you studied ethnomusicology and you've done a lot of Eastern European music and other kind of music. Does that interact with your contra playing at all? Are they separate worlds for you, or how do they inform each other?
You know, I think they're pretty separate worlds. They're just another passion that I have, and that started very young for me. I grew up with neighbors who were Croatian, and their three daughters who were around my age all belonged to a little Croatian folk dance group in Minnesota, and they invited me to be in that group, and I started folk dancing when I was 9, basically, and we had little costumes, and we performed at Festival of Nations, at the State Fair, at, you know, we learned songs, and we were all friends who were in this little dance troupe together, and we'd sit out on the playground at school and sing Croatian folk songs. And I was, you know, sort of half French-Canadian and part Swedish, and, you know, wasn't anything part of my ethnic heritage, but I got really drawn into it and at a very early age. And then in college, at the University of Minnesota, it was huge. There were huge folk dance groups like that met every Tuesday night in front of the student union with like 200 people dancing. It was great. It just became my whole world. And a bunch of us started performing ensemble, which still exists today as a really semi-professional ensemble in the Twin Cities. And yeah, it was a very rich time. And then one of my professors said to me, you should apply for a Fulbright to go to Eastern Europe. And she really held my hand through the process of doing that. And I got it. And I went to Yugoslavia for 2 years, 2.5 years. Hmm. In the 70s, yeah.
Wow. This is
a while ago, and it was during communist Yugoslavia, and I learned the language and just did a lot of field work and a lot of festivals and dance camps over there that were for leaders of folk ensembles, and I would go to them. And yeah, it was quite an amazing time of my life to do that. I was like 23. Mm-hmm. I was a baby, you know.
Yeah. And then you became involved in Village Harmony.
Right. Yeah. That became right at the beginning, like the first year, Larry Gordon called me up and he said, I'm thinking of starting a camp for teenagers. And I heard you do a lot of Balkan music. Would you like to come and teach at it? And I went, oh, yeah, sounds great. So we did like one camp that summer and it went really well. And then the next summer we did like two camps. And then we did like two camps in this country and one in England. And it just started growing. But at this time, the same time that was happening, Yugoslavia was falling apart. With civil war. And Village Harmony wasn't doing very many international camps at that point yet, but they started evolving more of the international camps, and I proposed to them that I'd like to do camps in Eastern Europe, and they paid for me to go on a research trip in 2005 to Bosnia and figure out how to create a camp there. And So that was kind of the beginning of doing camps there. And so since 2006 until today, I think I've done like 11 camps in Eastern Europe.
Wow.
And Quebec. Last summer, two summers ago, no, last summer in 2019, we did our first Quebec camp with Nicholas Williams was my co-leader, and
yeah.
I'm blanking out on her name. She's an amazing singer from Quebec City, and I'm blanking on her name. I'm really sorry. But we had a great camp with about 25 campers, and from teenagers to every age from all over the States and Canada. And we toured, we spent a week, a kind of idyllic week on this lake where Nicholas had gotten married. It's beautiful. And then we toured and we got to play and sing at this great festival, Mémoire et Racine. That's a great festival.
Yeah.
And we did many concerts there, and then kind of a concert at the main stage between acts. We kind of did flash mob in the audience.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, we kind of were there as flash mobbers, actually, doing our thing. And they gave us free admission and meals and everything to be there for the weekend. And it was really, really great for us. And then we toured other areas of Quebec, and Pascal joined us for some of the time, Pascal Jem, and we had some dances in some areas, and yeah, it was just a great. So that's a place where my Village Harmony world and my contra dance world kind of came together, was doing the Quebec camp, and that was a first, that camp up there.
So when you're doing dances, are they contra dances?
No, they were Quebecois dances.
Yeah, Quebecois dances, like Veillé style, like quadrilles and things like that.
Yep.
So much fun. It's one of my favorite kinds of dancing.
Yeah, and Pascal's wife, Marie Soleil, is a caller. Yes,
yeah,
so she came and called, and yeah, it was great. And that was the last international camp that I did, and who knows when they'll happen again.
Yeah.
Since everything this summer got canceled. And yeah. But otherwise, I don't, it's just sort of part of everything, like all the different kinds of music I love. But another way that my involvement in New England dance evolved was into doing music with children a lot and creating New England Dancing Masters with Peter and Mary Alice Amadon and Andy Davis. Yeah, and the four of us. In the early 90s, we kind of saw a need in the music teaching world. We were all music teachers, and we saw a need for a good book with the dances really clearly written out and with really good recordings.
Is that good Chimes music. Of Dunkirk?
Chimes of Dunkirk.
Yeah.
And that led to another book and another book. And, now we've got a whole series of books doing dance with communities or with children and early childhood singing games. And, we're just about to put out another book with another person that we've started working with. But anyway, it's really evolved into quite a big influence, I think, in the music education world.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've had the experience of going to, like, national music educator conferences and people coming up and wanting to take our photograph because their students love our music so much and love doing the dances, so they wanted to take a picture home for their students or things like that, yeah.
And did you do a lot of school residencies?
I did. The money kind of dried up for them. Mm-hmm. But for a while, I had some that I did kind of regularly every year that were really wonderful, where I had a lot of amazing support. And so I think Peter and Mary Alice did more residencies. They really focused on that a lot more. And Andy was really the music, public school music teacher warrior of all of us. He just retired, I think, 2 years ago. And he really did it for 30 years. A great job. But I think though that our sort of library of books has really moved all over the country and other continents, New Zealand, Australia, the British Isles.
That's amazing. This is Andy Davis, by the way, in case anyone is forgetting the earlier reference. Well, it's interesting because when you're trying to pass on a tradition or build community, there's so many different ways to do it. For some of us, a lot of us, it's as young adults or not young adults. You know, someone takes us to a dance and we discover it. Or there's this whole generations of kids who have been brought up because their parents were dancers and they get brought up going to Pine Woods or going to their local dance and they grow up in it.
Yeah.
But then there's like schools and like teaching the general public about the traditions that come right here from New England.
Yeah. Yeah, it was so great to do that. And, you know, most of my residencies ended with a dance, a family dance, with the whole community of parents joining in. And
I love that stuff. It is out of all the fun, exciting, glamorous, well, I don't know how contra dances ever get glamorous, but even for the most exciting contra dance, I also just love the feeling of a really great family dance.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. And especially when the kids are like teaching their parents the dances. Mm-hmm. They're the experts.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a residency that I did every year for many, many years in Westminster West, tiny little school. And there was just a wonderful, very inspired head teacher there, Claire Oglesby, bless her. And she would just hire me every spring, every May, for like the month of May, to come work with her her kids doing a program around some ethnic tradition. But I always did dancing, and we always had a family dance, and it was always very moving and very I just have amazing, beautiful memories of these spring nights with the whole family in the Westminster West Church dancing. And it was just very joyful and just kind of the epitome of community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder how many of these kids get to like have it be a part of their lives going forward, if it's just something they do in school and then, you know, versus how many of them discover these traditions and go to them later.
Yeah. You never know.
Like, I remember we did not have the chimes of Dunkirk in my school when I was, I mean, it was before that by far, but like we had to do square dancing and it was awful and awkward and I didn't want to hold Kenny's hand and, you know, like those kind of moments.
Yeah.
And I just love the thought. It was like sort of an afterthought, like 3 days of PE class were square dancing. And that's our entire traditional dance and music exposure of my entire childhood.
Right.
So what a wonderful change.
It's really nice when you can make it the culture of your school, you know. And I think that's what Andy was able to do for generations of kids here in Brattleboro. And where dancing is just really a normal part of weekly, daily life in their school.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the community.
Do you have thoughts about what changed with the residencies? Like you mentioned the money dried up. Is it different priorities or funding or do you know? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I think that often they were funded by grants. That dried up.
Mm-hmm.
Vermont Council on the Arts. Yeah, they just stopped getting funded. I remember like Mary Alice at the end of her residencies, the places that she still got funded were the Hudson Valley of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And she had regular gigs there that she would go to every year. And somehow they managed to keep their funding going longer than most of the Vermont schools and probably New Hampshire. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd be curious to see, like, if this is state funding from various arts councils, like, what are the cultural changes? And do they have less funding in general, or are they funding other things now? If anyone wants to look into that, have fun. Get back to us.
Yeah. It's really fun to go into school where the teacher, the music teacher, really is excited about your repertoire and wants to learn how to use it better with yeah. their students. And so you feel that enthusiasm from the teacher and that investment in it, and that the students feel that. That's really satisfying to do. And as opposed to like the case where you might get hired to come in and do a resume because they need to satisfy their dance.
Right.
Right, in the dance component of their curriculum, you know, right. and that's a very different thing. But my favorite kind of residencies were the ones where you could clearly tell the music teacher is really, and or the head teacher of the school is really believes in this and is excited and enthusiastic about it as well.
Hmm. Wonderful. Well, I hope to have all of those folks on the podcast, and then we could talk about that more too, which will be great, and hear like some of Andy's perspectives. We had Arthur Davis on the podcast. So.
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah, so yep. it'll be fun to chat with Andy sometime.
Yep.
So let's go back to kind of like the mainstream contra world for a moment, whatever that is.
Yeah.
What are the kind of dances that you play? Like, were they mostly local in New England? I know you also played big festivals with Air Dance, and I know you did a lot of touring for years.
Yeah.
I want to hear stories. What were your stories like from those times?
Gosh, you know, yeah, well, regularly, you know, I was playing in Greenfield second, fourth, and fifth Fridays, and often Stuart's dances too on second and fourth Saturdays, I guess, and, you know, in Boston, the Cambridge dances, and yeah, and then various festivals, some with the Greenfield Dance Band, some with, and then lots with the Air Dance. Air Dance was really a touring band. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas Greenfield Dance Band is really a house band that occasionally toured. Not really toured, did a festival here, the Down East Festival or this Old Songs Festival, particularly, mostly local. But Air Dance really traveled everywhere, you know, and that was exciting and fun, you know, I think. It was really fun doing, for example, Alistair Fraser's camp, Valley of the Moon.
Oh, cool.
In California, and doing a big concert with him, and, you know, doing the Sidmouth Festival. A couple different times I've done that Sidmouth Festival. But maybe once with Village Harmony and once with Air Dance. And that's a big festival in the south of England, and really... so many great musicians there, and people who are heroes of mine, you know, were there. And also we did a folk week through Folkworks in Durham, England, which was like a dance camp here, but it was music, just music, not dance. I taught piano at that week.
Contra piano specifically?
Contra piano specifically, yeah. Yeah, and there's... one person in particular in England who's probably kind of like you. Yeah, he really took everything in that I taught that week. And I did a singing thing that week as well. And that was so I'm really grateful for all of those opportunities. Go a lot to Alaska to, you know, stay. I think I've probably been to like 25 states, you know, doing those festivals. But at a certain point, I have to say, just environmentally speaking, it just didn't feel like such a great thing to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Hopping on airplanes to play contra dances.
Yep.
And I started really, you know, as there became more and more consciousness of the climate issues that we're facing, you know, it just became clearer to me that I couldn't do that. I needed to cut back flying to the bare necessities, like what I need to do mostly to see family or, for example, you know, things that are really... So, yeah, and I'm really curious to see how that unfolds after COVID, because the flying world, you know, it's become very clear to environmentalists how much cleaner the planet is without a lot of flying. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder how that's going to affect, like, how things will change because of that, and the need we have to be really conscious of what we're doing to the planet and with the climate. So. Yeah, and I'm grateful I had those opportunities. They were enriching, they were fun. I met so many great people and great musicians and other bands. And at the same time, I feel like, okay, I'm happy to stay in New England now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that might come out of this, I hope that we, when we can be given to be with each other more, is invest more in our local communities.
Exactly. Yeah, I totally agree. Yep, in every way, from family dances on up.
Mm-hmm.
Really
really focusing on them. It would be, yeah. Yeah, it's just going to be interesting to see how that all unfolds once the world opens up again.
Yeah, like I hope we kind of don't all go back to our old ways in every way, you know, like we take some of these good things out of here. And, you know, I've often wondered, like, what is it to be a touring contra dance band? Like, why is that a thing? It's fun, but I've often thought about my own carbon footprint.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yep.
But then I'm like, oh, but we were going to go play at Sidmouth, and I really wanted to before all this happened, you know? So it's like, oh, but I love seeing all these different communities, and it's tricky.
Yeah.
It's tricky. I'm glad that you're able to live by your values.
Yeah. Well, I feel grateful that I can, and to a great extent, that's because of the choral music that I'm, my choirs really are supporting me at this point.
Our local. Did you ever play like pickup contrabands?
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time. Yeah. And that's something that I think happens less and less. It's more band centric. Dances are more, and weekends are more band centric than they used to be. And I would say I played in pickup bands a lot in the past. And it just doesn't seem to be happening that much anymore. It didn't seem to be before. But I'm, you know, I don't really have my finger on the pulse of the last few years as I've gotten more involved in the choral music and organizing camps in other countries and whatnot. I've kind of lost my sense of what the pulse is.
Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, from where I sit, it seems like it's only continued to go in that direction, towards bands and away from pickup bands.
Definitely. And I think the internet really helps promote that, you know, and people's easy access to, and young people growing up just really being savvy about it. Like, my generation wasn't so savvy about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we didn't do self-promotion. It all happened word of mouth.
Yeah. Or David Kaner's handwritten dance flyers.
Handwritten dance flyers. Yeah. They're like collector's items.
They are. Beautiful calligraphy. And,
yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or Anne Percival's, you know, hand-painted dance flyers.
Yeah, very, very colorful and, yeah.
The Guiding Star Grange has had some good traditional dance flyers over the years. Some really nice art. Maybe they're the hub of dance artwork.
Absolutely.
In addition to music.
I agree.
Yeah. So did you play dance weekends as a pickup band ever? Or were they mostly interested in like air dance or bands with names?
Nope, both. I've done both. Yep. Just a couple of years ago, I mean, actually, I did a dance weekend a couple of years ago in Missouri, and they wanted the sound that was on Green Mountain.
Ah.
So Mary Lee and I and Sam Bartlett did that one. That was fun.
I wish organizers would write. That's like my favorite sentence to hear from an organizer would be like, we want that beautiful New England sound.
Yeah. So, and that's happened. There was a dance weekend in California that also wanted that sound, and I did that and ended up doing that with Sarah Blair and Stewart, I think, and maybe another person, I can't remember. There's definitely been over the years various times that I've done where, the organizer isn't just trying to hire the hottest band of the moment, but they like a sound and they want you, they'll call one. They rarely would call me. It's usually a fiddler.
Yeah.
But occasionally and say, bring this sound.
Mm-hmm.
So that was great. I loved that. But yeah, I doubt that happens very much anymore. But another change I was thinking from the generation of the 70s, 80s, early 90s is that
so many musicians now are so highly educated, musically educated. Like so many fiddlers now come out of NEC or Berkeley or, you know, really, they're real professional musicians, you know, have really studied their instrument on a deep level. And I think a lot of how it was passed in the past was just from musician to musician or through families or, you know, and not so much a higher education degree, you know, in it, in a, you know, well, because it was folk music, but it's really been taken to a high level of skill, you know, by a lot of wonderful musicians, and it raises the bar and the sort of professionalism of the of a band, you know, and being really savvy about websites and promotion and all that. None of that existed in the 80s and early 90s. It was a really different world.
Yeah, then maybe organizers get used to that, and so a pickup band looks less like. Also, dancers expect a name band. They come because they want to know who's playing, just like you choose what concert to go to. And so they won't necessarily take a chance on the organizer saying, don't worry, I have this really great band for you. Yeah. They want to know who it is and what it is and go to their website. And it is funny, like, I don't know if dancers think we like to promote ourselves, but I think most of us are pretty uncomfortable doing it.
Yeah.
Writing a bio is literally my least favorite thing in the whole world. It's just not fun.
Yeah.
And I mean, some bands love it and thrive on it, but a lot of them just don't want to do it or do it because we have to or because.
Yeah. And I think people who go and major, you know, in it at Berkeley, they have classes in running your business.
Yeah.
You know, so they
absolutely
they come out with skills on how to do that we never learned.
Right. And classes in stagecraft and all these other elements of being a professional musician.
Yep. It's a really different world. Yep.
And I always hope that there's room in the contra world for all those things.
Yeah. And I think there probably is. But I think that it tends towards people wanting a, you know, a name band that's got a fancy website and, you know, are lots of recordings. And yeah, I think that's more the direction things had been going in. We'll see where it goes from here. Yeah, I feel like for me, I've made enough recordings. I've traveled enough and I'm happy to work locally. And
yeah,
I'm happiest playing small local dances, weddings, family dances, that kind of thing right now.
Who are the folks that you play with most often these days?
You know, well, these days it's during COVID, so right, well, I get together with people on porches, you know.
Yeah.
Mary Lee and I get together quite a bit. Mm. Play French and Scandinavian music a lot. And
I'd love to be a fly on that wall.
It's very
fun.
Sounds
really fun.
Yeah, and Andy and I get together some and mostly play Quebecois music. We'll take turns playing accordion and piano.
I also want to be there.
Yeah. And actually, just a couple days ago, about five of us got together up in Alstead at Orchard Hill Bakery and played in their pavilion outside, kind of socially distanced from each other. And that was really nice. So just kind of pick-up-y things with, the Quebecois session 2 weeks ago was in Montague on the green. In
oh, really?
Oh, so I went down to Doug Creighton was leading it. And,
cool.
Yeah, so various things like that I've been trying to go to while the weather's warm.
Yep.
Which is about to change.
Yep. That's a whole tune to be written or an album, While the Weather's Warm.
While the Weather's Warm.
A song circle.
Yeah.
And then the other half of it is Now the Weather's Not.
Yep. We'll see what happens. We're back to Zoom, and more Zoom.
Oh, no.
I know. I'm doing my choirs on Zoom.
right now. And just because people want us keep together, I have recordings of almost, oh, like 25 years of concerts that are really good recordings. And I basically go over songs. We revisit songs we've sung in the past. I go over the parts. Mm-hmm. We sing along with the, I screen share and we sing along with the CD, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not the same. Everybody says it's not the same, but it's really all we have.
Yeah, and it's better than nothing.
And it's better than nothing. It keeps us connected as community. Yep. It keeps us singing. And the same, I've gone to some sessions online. Same thing.
Yeah. They're even having virtual concert dances. They've done a couple in the Grange in Greenfield. You know, a band sits there, just them and a caller, and they broadcast it out to people. And
you're just supposed to dance with imaginary people in your living room?
I haven't watched any of them because it's not what is emotionally drawing me in. We all have different reactions to these things.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly how it works. But yeah, maybe it's like a concert. Maybe you dance in your house if you want to. Maybe you watch it if you don't.
Yeah.
Some of them have been fundraisers. Yeah. So the dancing isn't the main point. I don't know. We could find out. But people are trying lots of different things to keep things going.
Yeah. And just keep connection. Keep the space in our lives for it.
I just miss like seeing people because, you know, like especially as musicians, we run into each other.
Yeah.
At gigs and dances, and we run into callers, and we run into dancers, and there's all these people, I don't even know all their names, I'm like, oh, you, dancy guy, you know, it's that guy.
Yeah,
and we always wave and say hello, like we've known each other for a long time, and now I'm like, I don't think I know what your name was, but I always remember smiling at you.
Exactly, yeah.
And I miss seeing everyone, we don't run into each other anymore.
Right, yep. Yeah, it's true. And so, yeah, that's why a lot of people are, like, for my choirs, they're signing up. Like, I have 100 singers right now.
And wow.
They just want to see each other.
Yep.
And we do breakout rooms, and they get to chat. That's fun. And it just keeps the connection going, and it gets songs going through or tunes going through people's heads instead of news.
Yes.
You know,
we have to keep that music and dance in our life. I mean, that's why we need it in our lives in the first place, right?
Exactly. It's so healing. So healing. And so I've been really focused on playing a lot and learning a lot of tunes and just trying to use this time in that way.
That's
especially
wonderful.
On accordion.
What kind of tunes are you learning right now?
Quebecois, French, and Scandi, basically.
Yeah. What parts of France?
Mary Lee and I play a repertoire of songs from an accordionist from France named Stéphane Delic.
Yes, he had waltzes in 5 and waltzes in 7.
Eight.
Yeah, yep. Wonderful.
Yeah, we play a bunch of those, and we love his repertoire, so that's some of it. And we play a bunch of bourrées and polkas and whatnot, I think, from Breton, mostly. And And we both love a lot of Scandi music, so we have quite a big repertoire of Scandi music that we play. And, you know, occasionally I try to go, when it's not COVID time, to the session, the Scandi session once a month in Greenfield. But I'm also usually teaching that night, Monday night. So it happens in my off seasons that I can go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I'm about to start taking some accordion lessons from someone I've only heard of but haven't met, but she went to NEC from Sweden, Suniva.
Oh, yeah, I know Suniva.
Yeah, I'm going to take a 6-week class with her.
Oh, fun. She's a great teacher.
Good.
We'll link to some of her music in the podcast notes. You know, it's like all this stuff isn't necessarily directly related to contra dancing, but a lot of contra dance musicians have interests in other traditional styles of dance music, and I think that's why I think it's interesting, you know, a lot of us dabble or visit or travel or immerse ourselves, you know, in these traditions.
Yep.
And they influence each other, you know, like David Kaner was excited about hambos and brought them here. And, you know, these little things like really end up influencing our community. And folks in past episodes have also talked about Ashokan as a place where you get all these different dance traditions all together, mingling together, and they all influence each other in little ways.
And definitely.
And there's a big ball folk push in the conscious dance community now and a lot of dances.
Yeah.
Which I'm personally very excited about.
Yeah, me too. I like it. And yeah, I'm excited to learn more of that music as well.
It's really great music.
Yeah.
I just love it so much.
Yep. That's the thing. There's just always more music to learn. And it's the exciting thing about loving music is that there's just always more. There's always that next tune to learn and to get excited about.
Yeah. Like for me, half of my family is French and the other half is French Canadian. And for whatever reason, I've just always had a special affinity for those two traditions.
You know, it's in your blood.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, all my grandparents spoke French. Both my grandmothers spoke French, but I didn't learn it as a kid, you know, like they don't pass it on. You know, you move to the United States and you assimilate. And like my grandmother always, she had 9 siblings or 8 siblings. I can't count. I feel like an awful great grandkid, but I can't remember how many there were.
Yeah.
But anyway, they all spoke French and sang crazy songs from Quebec and France. And you mentioned that you have French Canadian roots.
Yeah, my mom.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was.
Where is she from?
She was from Minnesota, but her grandparents came from Quebec to Minnesota.
And did that have any, like, direct impact on you? Like, did you grow up around French Canadian music, or did you discover
not around
it later?
The music? Yeah. But my grandfather spoke the language, and I remember hearing it, you know. But I did. Because Minnesota has such a big Scandinavian population, I heard Scandinavian music. Well, when I started folk dancing again when I was an older teenager, like when I was like 18, then I started getting involved in Scandinavian dance, as well as Balkan and a lot of the different traditions that were really popular and thriving at that time. But there's always been a lot of Scandinavian music in Minnesota. And so I would say it was an early influence for me. And I bought my first accordion from an old Swedish guy in St. Paul who had a basement full of accordions. And I saw an ad in the paper. This is way before internet. And I called him up and he said, oh, come take a look. And bought my first accordion for $30 from him.
Wow, that's a good price for an accordion.
Yeah,
that could be very expensive.
I know. Yeah, my most recent one was $5,000.
Yeah, so. And that's even a good price. Like, can't think of even worse than that.
Yeah,
it's crazy. Such a specialized piece of equipment.
Yes.
Sometimes I think it's crazy that we play accordions. Like, they only depreciate, and they're very expensive. But they're wonderful.
Oh, they're great.
It's worth every penny.
Absolutely. I love my accordion and I love all the different traditions I can play on it. Also the Balkan traditions, and there's just so many great traditions that have accordion in them.
Yeah. You would play piano accordion.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are some of your favorite contra dance tunes to play? Like things that, like tunes from Quebec?
Definitely tunes from Quebec, all kinds of them, but also just really like the chestnuts of New England, like Money Musk. I could play Money Musk every week and be happy, or Lamplighter's Hornpipe, or Fisher's Hornpipe, and really the classics, Lady of the Lake. I love all those tunes, and yeah. So I would say those are really some of my favorites, and then just lots of French Canadian tunes. Like, I don't have specific names in mind, but I love them all.
Yeah, and if you're listening to bands like albums like Héritage, and like, yeah, there's just so many like classic Quebecois albums. It's just wonderful tunes and wonderful repertoires. And
yeah, so they were really great, and they really inspired me. And the early versions of La Bottine also, they got a little loud and a little more rambunctious. And I think a lot of people like that. But I liked the simpler version.
They're more tune-based.
Tune-based, yeah. Yeah. Yep.
You could hear the tune and enjoy it.
Yeah, I was shocked at Memoir Racine last year when the band Le Vent du Nord was there. And I have a lot of their albums, and they're really traditional sounding. And, whoa, at this festival, they were all about electric guitar and electric bass.
Yeah, and they have André Brunet now. Is that right?
I guess so, yeah. But I was just so surprised at how electrified they were at this. Maybe they just do that for festivals, or maybe there's recent recordings I don't know about that are more electrified, but I really appreciate their harmonies and their earlier sound, I guess. Yeah.
Well, I think even the way some of these bands are mixed is different now, like the way the foot percussion is mixed.
Yeah.
A few of these wonderful Quebecois bands, but they have like very bassy foot percussion. It's like, ooh, and they bring their own mixing engineers, like a lot of bands do.
Right.
So you can control your own sound, and it's just
it's
an oomphier sound for sure.
Definitely. Definitely.
But it's oomphier. It's a bit of a stylistic change, you know, but maybe it's like they're responding to what audiences want. Probably they're also doing what they want to be doing, you know?
Right, exactly.
Like, that's what music sounds like now.
Yep.
In other places.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious, like, about arranging and, like, because you play in a lot of pickup bands where you don't necessarily arrange. And then something in a band like Air Dance, how much of that was arranged for you as, like, a rhythm player? What was your role in, you know, putting sets together or deciding how things went? How much of what you played was arranged versus made up on the fly?
Ooh. I would say that we had sets that we had recorded that had certain aspects to them that we would probably repeat as we played them for dances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but also we would just put together tunes on the fly. And so, I don't know. I don't think of myself as, I think more of the arranging just happened intuitively, as except for the things that were at, you know, set in recordings.
Right.
But we would never play it exactly the same as that recording, of course. But there were certain things that we would be excited about on our recording of it that we would incorporate into a live situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like a lot of arrangements come about because you're about to make a recording, and then you're like, oh, wait, now we have to decide how this goes, and we have to make it interesting.
Yeah.
And then you take that back and you flesh it out into a 9-minute or 8-minute dance set. Or
right. Whatever.
But you would not really like through compose 8 minutes of an arrangement for a contra dance.
Never.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah.
That's kind of suffocating to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you might take rhythm breaks, or people would take solos or trade off on melody and harmony, or you'd probably do chord subs.
Yeah.
Like probably you and Stuart would coordinate on those.
Mostly intuitively, or was it like an eyebrow lifted, you know?
Right.
Like we know what's coming.
Yeah. You just feel it. I mean, when you work together long enough, you just feel what's coming and you know what the thing is going to be.
Yeah, kind of like that. Definitely a lot of intuition and just years of repetition. Definitely.
Yeah. But that can give it a freshness
Yeah.
You know, there have been bands, and I think that's another trend in the last 10 years of more like really arranged material where you have an arrangement that goes for a whole concert dance, and you might shift it a little bit in terms of how long you stay in each section, but the arrangement happens every time. There have been some bands that have been very arranged. I think that's a, not all bands now do it, but there were bands like Great Bear Trio, or then just Great Bear, Perpetual Emotion. Not all their sets were like that, but a lot of them were. Nor'easter would dabble in that, where we had some that were very improvisatory, some sets, and then some where we had like an arc that was going to happen through the whole dance.
Yep.
And that's it's another change.
Yep. But
when you're playing with a fiddler like Rodney, he has a really large repertoire of tunes.
Yeah, he did.
And kind of endless whims, it seems like.
Yeah, enormous creativity. Definitely.
Yeah, and so that takes you in different places. Like you play as a, I would imagine you play differently as a rhythm player to support that kind of fiddling.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think you shift to support the various different kind of fiddlers that you play with, you know, in various ways. And I'm not sure that I could even articulate what those ways would be. Yeah, it's more intuitive or, but definitely I'm sure that it happens. And I feel really grateful that I've gotten to play with lots of wonderful people and over the years, and it's been really enriching and really enriching and exciting and creative.
And you've left us with a lot of great albums, which I'm so happy about.
Yeah, they're still out there, some of them, and some of them aren't even available. I occasionally send people a thumb drive of Green Mountain.
Wow, that's great. Oh, Green Mountain is such a good album.
Thank you.
I love it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have been playing your licks for years, and I teach some of my students the licks that I learned from you that you learned from Mario or, you know, whoever else before you, or from Bob McQuillan. And
yeah,
that's...
And the tradition goes on.
And it goes on, and it gets filtered and changed through each person it passes through.
Yep.
And each time...
They make it their own, and it evolves and moves on and changes. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
Gee, I don't think so. I think that covers a lot.
Yeah, we covered a lot.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming. It's been so wonderful to see you again and so great to talk to you. Thank you.
It was an honor for me. And it's a great project that you're involved with here. I'm really glad you're doing it.
Oh, thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to ContraPulse. This project is supported by CDSS, the Country Dance and Song Society, and is produced by Ben Williams. Thanks to Great Meadow Music for the use of tunes from the album Old New England by Bob McQuillan, Jane Orzechowski, and Deanna Stiles. Visit ContraPulse.cdss.org for more info. Happy dancing!